It's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Daniel, Dr. Daniel Lasker, who is the Norbert Blechner Professor at Ben-Gurion University. He teaches, he specializes in medieval Jewish thought, as well as the Gaonic and Karaite period. Those of you who were here for his talk this morning on the Karaites, it was absolutely fascinating and illuminating talk. And in this talk, he is going to discuss how Jewish philosophers read the Bible. Mea culpa, Jay and I forgot to photocopy his source from the guide ahead of time, so it's completely our fault. So I don't know if we have any copies extant, but I'm sure that Professor Lasker will illuminate us all.
Thank you very much. The real purpose I wanted for the handout is that often when I say to people what Maimonides said, they don't believe me. And therefore, having a textual proof would help. Of course, they could say, well, that's only the English translation. It's obviously mistranslated. So I guess I could have prepared the Arabic, the Judeo-Arabic handout, but I don't know if that, how much that would have helped. I mean, this is only a bilingual country, not a trilingual. Is that correct? Well, anyway, I want to thank people in Torah in Motion to inviting me back to Toronto for a second time and having me talk at this very exciting day. Let me start out by telling you something I do in my first year introductory survey to medieval Jewish philosophy. I ask my students whether, according to the Bible, God has a body. Of course, we use fancy terms. Is God corporeal or incorporeal? Does God have a body? So let me start out by asking the people here, according to the Bible, does God have a body or does God not have a body?
According to the literal translation, he has a body. According to the Rambam, it says he has a body. Indeed, according to the Bible, there are many people greater than the Rambam, it says he has a body.
Okay. So what's the correct answer?
A, B, or C, Bumble Church.
You remind me of a colleague of mine who asked me something about providence, and I said, well, the Rambam says this, and the Rabbag says that. He says, well, what do you believe? I said, I believe the Rambam says this, and the Rabbag said that. But does someone want to give an unequivocal answer to that question? Does, according to the Bible, does God have a body?
Yes.
So we have one yes. Anybody want to disagree with that? Well, okay, as a ruach, it also says, you know, yad and regel and... okay, great. This is the answer I usually get from my students after they say, of course God doesn't have a body. And I said, but wait, it says yad, it says regel. And they said, but it says, ein lo demuta guf, ein no guf. So I said, where does it say he has no body or like a body? Ein lo guf, ein demuta guf. And they said, well, lo yodeh, ze ketuv eizeh shu makom, which means, I don't know, it's written someplace, obviously, you know, maybe it's on Genesis, maybe it's in Exodus, I don't know, you know, it's, or as my kids who participated in the Bible quiz might say, ze lo bachomer, it wasn't in the material, so they don't have to know it, all right? But as you pointed out, where does it say it? It says the Yigdal. What is the Yigdal? Yigdal is a poetic rendition of Maimonides' 13 principles. And Maimonides, as pointed out, says very specifically, God doesn't have a body, and if you believe that God has a body, you're in big trouble. And so this became introduced, and especially our students, the students at least come from the religious school system in Israel, and they accept it as being like a literal verse in the Bible. And if you say, but what about hand? What about foot? What about God's mouth? What about God's talking? God goes up, God goes down. They said, no, that's all allegorical. Ain't lo demuta guf, ain't no guf. And what strikes me from the fact that I get these answers is the success of the medieval Jewish philosophers. In other words, it was not so clear, let's say in Chazal, in rabbinic times, that they accepted an incorporeal God. I mean, after all, what does the Jewish God do, according to the rabbis? What does he do when he gets up in the morning? Excuse me? He puts on his tefillin. I don't know if that's before or after he washes his hands. But All right, he puts on tefillin. Rashi Rabbein Tzal. He has special tefillin. He doesn't have a problem because he has Mikam Chai Yisrael Goy Echad Ba'aretz. He has a different verse in the tefillin than we have in our tefillin. Okay? So, of course, so God presumably has a body. Presumably he has a male body. Otherwise, he wouldn't be putting on tefillin unless he's a postmodernist or something, maybe, if we don't know. Good question. It talks about humans being created in the image of God. Well, that would seem to maybe indicate that God has an image. But the medieval philosophers, who you might say introduced what they did as a result of the influence of Greek philosophy, and they were accused of this, were so convincing that this is some way in which the philosophers won the day. In most of the fights between the philosophers and the Kabbalists, or between the philosophers and the literalists, or the people who read Midrash simple manner, most of these, the philosophers lost. I'll get back to it later. But in the matter of incorporeality, the philosophers won. And this was a way of reading the Bible allegorically or metaphorically. Sa'adja Gaon in the 10th century is one of the first to do this. And he went through the Bible systematically and said, well, look, we talk about the foot of the mountain. We talk about the head of the bed. Does the mountain have a foot? Does the bed have a head? No. So we can talk about God's arm without saying that God has an arm. And it was Rabbeinu Bachi ibn Pakuda in the 11th century in Spain who apparently is the first one to use the expression Dibrat Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam. Now, the expression comes from the rabbis, but the application to theology is medieval. Let me just stand back and explain for a minute. This expression was used in the panel. The Torah speaks in the language of humans. Dibrat Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam. This is a legal principle that is used by some of the rabbis to justify their halachic position in terms of how to understand the Torah. What is interesting is that this position, held by Rabbi Ishmael as opposed to Rabbi Akiva, is the losing position. This position in halacha is wrong. That if you want to know whether or not you derive certain laws from certain verses, you don't adopt the position Dibrat Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam, the Torah speaks as humans. But the philosophers adopted this view, they adopted this phraseology, and it swept the Jewish world, I might say, to the extent that if I get two things when I ask this question, does a biblical God have a body? I'll get Ein Lo Dmut HaGuf, Ein No Guf, and Dibrat Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam. And as pointed out, Maimonides says, if you believe that there's a God, if you believe in one God, and I'd add in parentheses, and you observe all the mitzvot, if that were possible, and yet you believe that this God has a body, even if you believe this body is not like other bodies, you have no portion in the world to come. In other words, you're a good Jew, very nice, gegesunte heit, you know, we'll honor you, whatever, but when you die after 120 years, there's no continuation because you thought God had a body. And if you think God has a body, you are wrong. Your intellect is mistaken. Ravad, Rabbi Avram ben David, the person who wrote the glosses on Maimonides, says, how can he say this? Better and greater people than the Rambam believe that God had a body because of the literal interpretation of the verses and the Midrashim. Now, of course, this is very difficult. The statement by the Ravad is very difficult because it says greater and better people than the Rambam. Now, how many greater and better people in the Rambam were there? Well, excuse me? You don't know of any. So that's indeed the question. Why did the Ravad say this when it's unclear that there are so many greater and better than the Rambam? Of course, he was using it sort of for emphasis, overkill. He was quite angry at the Rambam. Well, what did the Kabbalists do to what the Rambam said? They said, well, God doesn't have a body. God has things which represent God, the spherot, the 10 spheres. But everyone will tell you, those who know about these spherot, will say, well, that's not literal either. Those are metaphorical. Those are sub divine, the real divine name. So it has no body, etc. So, as I said, philosophy won this battle. And why should God be incorporeal? Maimonides says in the guide, part 2, chapter 25, he says that the reason we interpret these words metaphorically is twofold. First of all, because it's proven by philosophy. And second of all, it's not harmful to religion. It's even helpful to religion. You're much better religiously to believe in an incorporeal God than to believe in a corporeal God. I don't know if that's true psychologically. It seems that a lot of people do believe or like to believe in a God who is a father figure or a grandfather figure, large throne, big beard, and this is the one who's going to take care of me as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death or some other place like that. So philosophers read the Bible as a book with metaphorical descriptions of God. But that's not the end of the story. That's the easy part. That's the part that everybody, no one gets, I'd say, offended. If you say to them, the Bible doesn't mean that God has a hand, I don't get students who say, of course God has a hand. How can you deny God has a hand? How can you be such a heretic to deny God's hand? No one, that doesn't bother anybody. But Maimonides in the guide, in the introduction, says the purpose of the story, the purpose of the Bible, I'm sorry. Maimonides says in the introduction to his book, The Guide of the Perplexed, that the purpose of his book is to explain two things. Difficult or problematical words and difficult and problematical parables. The Bible not only has words like hand and leg, whatever, it has stories or parables which aren't so clear. And Maimonides gives two examples in his introduction. He says some parables, every word has an important message. And he gives the example of the ladder of Jacob. Jacob's ladder. Jacob is going out of the land of Israel and he lays down to sleep. And what does he see? He sees a ladder with its base on the earth, its top in the heavens, and he sees the angels of God ascending and thereafter descending. Now, is that a parable? According to Maimonides, yes. Of what is it a parable? What did Jacob understand when he had this vision in his dream? He understood that there is an obligation for the believer, or every human, to ascend the ladder toward God. And when one reaches the top of the ladder and understands God and has removed him or herself from corporeality and the affairs of this world, what does the person then do? Come down again. And where does Maimonides learn this? From Plato. Plato had a parable of the cave. That after the person in the cave who is along among all these people who think reality is just a shadow and goes out into the real world and sees the light, first it hurts the eyes, and then eventually the person understands the truth. Now, what should that person do? Well, if he's concerned only about himself, what should he do? Keep out of the cave. But he has to have a concern also for the people in the cave, and therefore he returns. So the ladder of Jacob has to do with intellectual cognition and the responsibility of the person who has that cognition to return to the real world, as it were. So, is that offensive? Does he say Jacob didn't have the dream? No, he says Jacob did have the dream. We just have to explain it correctly. He gives one other example in Proverbs chapter 7. There is a description of a young man who is tempted, and perhaps it comes to temptation by a harlot, and there's a long description there of how he should avoid such temptations. Maimonides says this is a parable to leaving the spiritual world and going toward corporeality, basing himself also on Aristotle and Plato, where there's a comparison is made between males and form and females in matter, that the form of the male, which is more spiritual, obviously they had certain prejudices, should keep away from conjunction with material things, which would be the woman. So that's a parallel. It has nothing to do with prostitutes, etc. So this is what Maimonides says in his introduction. And as he goes through the book, The Guide of the Perplexed, he gives some examples and he explains what prophecy is and raises many questions. What I wanted to do in the handout, which you don't have, and you'll have to accept my word for it, is what Maimonides says. I mean, please go and check it with the original Judeo-Arabic. Maimonides says that we have to understand prophecy. What is prophecy all about? And in the second half of the second part of the guide, Maimonides describes how prophecy comes about. And his description is very naturalistic. What does it mean, naturalistic? He says that there is emanations from God which pass through the different intellects which are between God and humans. This emanation, this overflow, arrives to the person who is trained to be a prophet, hits first the intellectual facility, is transferred to the imaginative facility, and then the person prophesies. I gave a talk once, we have a general course in Jewish thought for people who are not majors. What I like to call, Columbia has this economics for non-economists and physics for non-physicists. Well, we have Jewish thought for non-thinkers. So I'm trying to explain how the Rambam makes prophecy naturalistic by this divine emanation through the intellects, the active intellect. And someone said, well, excuse me, that's natural? That's a scientific explanation? So I said, okay, it doesn't sound scientific today, but in his own day, that was a scientific explanation. All right, so the prophecy is explained, and Maimonides actually says, at most, what God does is prevent someone who otherwise should be a prophet from being a prophet. In other words, the idea that God would come to some person someday, let's say, who is plowing in his fields, like Elisha, and said to him, you're a prophet? No, that is not, that's metaphorical. In order to be a prophet, one has to train for prophecy. One has to have a sophisticated imagination and an intellect. And what's the whole point? Why do you need both an intellect and imagination? The intellect to understand the truth. The imagination to translate the truth into imagery that people will understand. More people are interested in reading the Song of Songs than are interested in reading Aristotle's Metaphysics. Now, if we want to reach, and that's the goal of Judaism, is to have a good society and to include everybody in the society, then you have to do it through parables, you have to do it through imagery that people will accept. That's why you need imagination. But behind this imagery has to be the truth. So then Maimonides says, now that I've explained what prophecy is and the levels of prophecy, let's describe how the prophets talk. And this is beginning of chapter 46 of the second part. And he starts out by saying, from one example, one should extrapolate from many examples. Example. Look at Ezekiel chapter 8. All right, let's see how people's becute here. What's in Ezekiel chapter 8? No, but that's one example my mind is using, but that's not in chapter 8. In the sixth year, in the sixth month, in the fifth of the month, I'm sitting in my house, and the elders of Judah are sitting in front of me, and the hand of God falls on me, and I see an image like the fire, and he describes God, or that's the problem itself, okay? And he sends out the image of a hand, and he takes me by the tzitzit of my head, by my hair locks. This is before Ezekiel apparently went bald, if he did. Okay, I don't know how he did it. Okay. And he takes me, a wind carries me between earth and heaven, and it brings me to Jerusalem, and I see visions of God to the entrance of the inner gate, which looks north, which is where the certain images sitting in the temple. In other words, he sees the idolatry in the Jerusalem temple. Okay. And he has a description of what happens. He knocks down a wall. He sees the women are bemoaning Tammuz, the god, etc., etc. All right. Did Ezekiel have a night voyage from Babylonia to Jerusalem? What does Ezekiel say? It seems like he's saying, I'm sitting there and suddenly God pulls my hair out and pulls me by the hair and takes me there, and he has a full description of what happens. What does Maimonides say? Obviously not. This was a vision. He says it's a vision. It never happened. Correct. So he's saying this didn't happen. What does it mean it didn't happen? It happened that he dreamed it or he had the vision. It didn't happen that he physically went from Iraq to Jerusalem by night express or however, like magic carpet or however God supposedly did it. Okay. He says, for instance, another example he gives is that God says to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. And he says that after these things, the word of God was to Abram in a vision, machazeh, a vision. And God says, don't fear, Abram, I'm with you. You'll have a great reward. And Abram says, well, how am I going to know? So he says, whatever. And then he says, go outside and look at the stars, whatever. Did Abraham get out of bed, go outside, look at the stars, then say, okay, I'll take myself all these different animals, the Yez Meshulash and the Eglah Meshulash and whatever, however we translate them, and make this sacrifice and whatever, and then this big furnace passed through it, whatever. Did any of this happen? It happened in Abraham's dream. Did Abraham go outside and sacrifice those animals or whatever? What does Maimonides say? No. Didn't happen. And then another example, the beginning of the book of Hosea. What does God tell Hosea at the beginning of the book? Go marry a prostitute. All right. Go marry this prostitute and the children of prostitution because the earth is prostituting itself from after God. And he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Divlaim, and she became pregnant. He had a son. The same son was Yisrael. And then he had another son, and the son's name is a daughter whose name was Lo Ruhama. Now, Ruhama is a nice Israeli name, right? Ruhama. Now, this daughter's name was Lo Ruhama, right? Etc. And then what does this woman do to Hosea? He leaves him. She applies her trade. She's disloyal. Infidelity. Whatever. Okay. And what does God say to Hosea? Now you know how I feel. And God uses some rather harsh language as to what He's going to do to the Jewish people for doing to him what Gomer did to Hosea. I have a colleague at Ben-Gurion University who would like this Haftorah, which is read for Haftorah, deleted from the canon because she thinks it leads to domestic violence. I sort of doubt it leads to domestic violence. After all, most people during the Haftorah aren't paying attention. But still, it's a very strong imagery, and it's imagery which is not particularly complimentary to women, let's say, but it's certainly very strong imagery. Was there a prophet named Hosea? Yes. Did he marry a woman named Gomer and have two children, Yisrael and Lo Ruhama, according to Maimonides?
No.
This was a dream. This was a vision.
He says, God forbid that God would degrade his prophets by either asking them to,
Correct. God forbid that God should do such a thing. All right. Now, if I were to read this passage in Hosea, would I think that Hosea had a wife named Gomer, etc.? Yes. But if I read it correctly, I would know no. Now, Maimonides says, he gives a few other examples. He says, these examples are obvious. No one in his right mind would think that that Ezekiel went on a night vision, night journey from whatever, from Iraq to Jerusalem. No one would think that God would ask a poor prophet to marry a prostitute. No one would think that Abraham would chop up these animals and a furnace would go through. So what he says is that all of these visions, even though they look like something happened, someone heard or came in or went out or said or was said about or stood or sat or rose or went down or traveled or asked or was asked, everything was in a prophetic vision. And even if it lasted a long time, after all, Hosea, he has two children. I mean, that's at least 18 months, let's at least, but let's say even more. I mean, it sounds like he's had a long time relationship. All this is in a prophetic vision. And what does Maimonides tell us at the beginning of the chapter, I said? From those passages which are obvious, learn about those passages which are not obvious. So if the story of Hosea didn't happen the way it's described, and the story of Ezekiel didn't happen the way it's described, what else didn't happen the way it was described? Any suggestions? Mahmoud Har-Sinai, good example. What else? Yeshayahu seeing God. Seeing, he doesn't see God, he sees a vision of God, so the visions are seen, but what exactly they mean... No, God touches his lips. That is a vision. I think most people would accept this vision. The Akedah, that's a very good example. The binding of Isaac. Now, does Maimonides say there was no Mamad Har Sinai, the Torah wasn't given on Sinai? Does Maimonides say that there was no binding of Isaac? Does Maimonides say there was no crossing the Red Sea? No, Maimonides never says it. Maimonides is very careful. He doesn't say that. Does he say it because he believes they happened and therefore there's no reason to say it? Does he not say it because he doesn't want to get into trouble? We don't know. Let's just leave it for a minute. And then in chapter 47, Maimonides says, well, you know, sometimes the Bible uses exaggerations. And sometimes exaggerations are true and sometimes exaggerations are not true. And again, you have to look very carefully. For instance, Og. Who was Og? King of Bashan. What was special about Og? It was a giant. How tall was he? Very tall. Okay. Well, first of all, two-thirds of the nine, amot is a cubit, is a half a meter. So if he were six amot, he'd be 3 meters. That's pretty tall. Okay, I mean, it's not tall enough to survive the flood, is what he did according to Chazal. Okay? But what does Maimonides say? Maimonides says, in the case where they describe Og's bed as being 9 cubits long, it's obvious that nobody is 9 cubits long. All right? I don't know. This is not a big... basketball city. I mean, even with the Raptors, right? I mean, in Israel, I'd use the example of Tachenko, who was the player for Moscow, CSKA Moscow, that was always the bane of the existence of Maccabi Tel Aviv. And this guy was, if you want to see Og, I mean, you know, this is Og personified. I mean, a real giant. Okay, Maimonides says, yeah, well, he wasn't 9 cubits long. He was about, you know, people's beds are usually longer than they are. So he had a specially made bed. You know, he was a king. He could special order. So his bed was 9 cubits tall. He was at most 6 cubits tall, 3 meters. All right, difficult, but possible. What about all these guys who lived 900 years old? All right. So again, you're going to tell me exactly what in my mind. I mean, you know, you need the handout. You got to put. Yeah. You have a Tana here who can. Okay, they were exceptions. Now, what's the problem? The problem is as follows. According to the Rambam, nature doesn't change. If nature doesn't change, how is it then the time of the first generations, people living 1,000 years, 950, 969, whatever, in our age they don't. So what does the Rambam say? He says, those people mentioned actually lived that long, maybe because of good nutrition or because of a miracle. But nobody else lived that long. And it's a very problematic statement. I once gave a talk on it. It's very interesting. I mean, it's not only sporting life and Porgy and Bess who says it ain't necessarily so, but there's a whole... as I point out, that's perhaps because he didn't read the Rambam, and maybe he did read the Rambam, maybe Paskin, according to Rav Sadia Gaon. I don't know what Sporting Life's or Gershwin's reading material was before he decided ain't necessarily so. But the Rambam says only those people. So in the Maimonidean dispute in the 13th century, and people were saying that what Maimonides was saying is not acceptable, that this is heretical. One of the examples given by a man named Rabbi Yehuda Al-Fahar, who is important in the history of Western philosophy because he's quoted by Spinoza. Anyway, he says the following. He says, what's the Rambam saying? He's saying is the equivalent of the Rambam says only certain people live that long, not everybody. He says it's like someone who comes and reports, I saw three camels flying in the sky. And someone else comes and says, no, it couldn't be. Camels don't fly. You saw only one. All right? So Maimonides says that only special people. And then the Ramban says that actually it was everybody because the Ramban is willing to Nachmanides to admit changes in nature. But even he tries to give a sort of naturalistic explanation that before the flood, there was less air pollution. So from creation to the flood, it was 900 years. After the flood, it was only 400 years because of the pollution. Then after the Tower of Babel went down to 150 or 200 years. Why? Because spreading out of the earth caused more pollution. The one that I like the best is Yitzchak Abravanel, Don Yitzchak Abravanel, who explains, based on previous authors, that the first generations lived long because, A, they were teetotalers. How do we know they were teetotalers? Noah was the first one to start planting, right? They were vegetarians. Why were they vegetarians? Because there's no permission to eat meat. And they were sexually abstinent for a long time. How do we know that? Because they had children aged 200, 250, 300. So as a result of being this good life, good living, they were able to live long. What happens? They start eating meat. They start eating, drinking wine. They start having sex at an earlier age. And then, life expectancy goes down. Well, the question is the verse in the Genesis chapter 6 about how God talks about not tolerating aiding humanity for more than 120 years. Some people take it to mean that now humans will live only 120 years. Others take it to mean that he gave them another 120 years before the flood. Obviously, there were people who lived more than 120 years after the flood, way after the flood. Abraham lived 175. Isaac lived 180. Jacob lived 147, right? So, but that's by now unusual, obviously. So Maimonides, on those occasions, says that one should take what's said literally, okay? But many words one should take as allegorical or exaggerated, and he gives a few other examples that we can skip over. And then he gets to chapter 48, a very interesting chapter. He says that there are four causes for things in the world. Sometimes they're natural, sometimes artificial, sometimes they're by their chance, sometimes they are by free will, by choice. And it says all four of these things the prophets will attribute to God. That, for instance, it says that God sent the big fish to eat Jonah. Right? Now, did God, look out to go to the, I don't know, the zoo or the aquarium and say, okay, you there? No. The fish swallowed Jonah. Again, I don't know. Maimonides, I'm not even sure, would believe that, that after all, it was Jonah's vision, perhaps. But it wasn't through extraordinary means. God sent the locusts. Doesn't mean God personally sent the locusts. It means locusts come by way of nature, and they did what they did. In other words, the prophets would attribute to God things that were not done through direct causality, that God works through intermediaries. In fact, for Maimonides, everything that happens in the world comes as a result of intermediary causes that the prophets say God did it, but God didn't necessarily do it. And he gives examples of all these things. Some things are by chance, some things are by nature, some things are by choice, some things are by happenstance. For instance, certain things that a choice will be human, the cause will be human choice. He says, like war, right? Or someone who decides to hurt somebody else, or to curse somebody else. And he talks about Nebuchadnezzar, the evil Nebuchadnezzar. It says that God says, I ordered him to destroy. But that was only through intermediary causes. In other words, it wasn't that Nebuchadnezzar got a call in the middle of the night on the cell phone and said, you know, this is God speaking, go destroy the temple. No. That's the all these things are attributed to God, but God didn't do. And I mentioned about animals. He says that sometimes that things are as a result of the will of an animal, and those are attributed to God. And then it says, and even those things which happen in absolute chance, I don't have the Arabic in front of me, but the absolute chance, they are attributed to God. Such is in the story of Rebekah. Vatehi isha leven adonecha kasher diber Hashem. Let her be the wife for the son of your master as God spoke. What does Laban say about Rebekah becoming the wife of Isaac? Well, God figured it out. God wants this to happen. We can't do anything about it. Go. What does Maimonides say? Pure chance. He came to the well. He said, okay, the next young lady who comes out, who offers me and my camels to drink, she'll be God's choice. And that's what happened. And we think the Torah had her all ready for Isaac. What is Maimonides says? Even those things which happen with absolute chance, such as in the story of Rebekah and the story of David and Jonathan, where Jonathan says to David, go because God is sending you. What does he say? No, chance. Ubefarshat Yosef, Yishlachenu Elohim lifnechem. When Joseph tells his brothers, God sent me in front of you. God sent Joseph down to Egypt. Did God send Joseph down to Egypt? The Bible says it, right? The Bible says, Joseph says, God sent me. All right? And what does Maimonides say? Absolute chance. Has nothing to do with divine will. And he says, Maimonides says, again, if I had the English, it would be easier, but this has now been explained to you how, when the causes are brought together, how they're caused brought together, whether they are essential causes or accidental causes or choiced causes or by will, all these words, sivui, amira, dibur, shlicha, kriya, when it says that God commanded or said or spoke or sent or called, know all this and act accordingly in every place according to its context, at which point strange things will disappear and the truth of the matter in this place, which seems far from the truth, will become clear. What is he saying? All the things which the Bible attributes to God are attributed to God through intermediary causes. And he gives examples, again, the servants of Abraham. We thought this was part of the divine plan. What is, I mean, the normal reader might think that. My mind says, no chance. Yes? Okay, so what do we do with creation, the creation story? And Maimonides struggles with the creation story. Now, it's hard to say the creation story is a prophetic vision, because we don't have said the prophet says, I saw the world being created, because the prophets weren't around at the time of creation of the world. Maimonides concludes that one cannot prove that the world was created. And when it has to keep in mind that Maimonides, when Maimonides is talking about creation, the other choice to creation was not evolution or the Big Bang as we think today, but eternity of the world, which meant everything the way it is now is the way it always was. Now, we know this is not true. We now believe in, I mean, some of us believe, or some of us think in terms of evolution, certainly the fact that there are species which have become extinct. I mean, all these things would show that Aristotle was wrong. They don't necessarily show the Bible is wrong, but they show that Aristotle was wrong. But Maimonides didn't know that there was a that Aristotle was wrong. He thought Aristotle was correct. And he said that between eternity of the world and creation of the world, basically the arguments are equivalent. And therefore, one cannot really prove creation of the world, even though he said he believes in creation of the world. And there's a great debate immediately after the guide was written as to whether or not Maimonides really did believe in creation of the world, and whether he believed in creation of the world out of nothing or out of something. But at least in the way he describes in these chapters, in terms of divine causation or in terms of allegory, that he doesn't comment on. He does in part 2, chapters 29 and 30, try to explain the creation story. Certainly for him, the story of Adam and Eve is an allegory. It's not necessarily literally true. And he tries to find what are the lessons from the story rather than use it as a historical fact. But if we heard before the question of how does one write history, or whether one depends on the Bible for history, we don't even know, according to Maimonides, the basic facts of the biblical narrative as to whether or not they're true. And let's go back to the question of the binding of Isaac. A number of commentators indeed said that the story of the binding of Isaac didn't happen. That according to Maimonides, it didn't happen. After all, what happens? It says that God appears to Abraham. He talks to Abraham. He commands him. And it could easily have been in a vision. The three-day walk and etc. Did Maimonides intend that? We don't know. In other words, Maimonides himself never says it. And what happened is when Maimonides' students, or some of his followers, said this, and not actual students, but people who read his works, other people said they are distorting what Maimonides said. Maimonides never intended that. It was part of the Maimonidean controversy. But you had in the Maimonidean controversy, for instance, the attack on the philosophers for saying that the 12 sons of Jacob were the 12 signs of the zodiac. Or that there's a midrash that Sarah was sitting in the lap of Abraham. That's an analogy of matter and form. And it led some people to believe that the philosophers at least were saying that everything was allegorical, that all the stories are allegorical. They didn't happen the way they're described. Let me just put in parentheses here that in all of these discussions, not one of the Jewish philosophers, the medieval Jewish philosophers, would say that the halakha was allegorical. And Maimonides, in the introduction to the guide, says specifically that he's not talking about sukkah and lulav and those other laws. That's not what he's talking about when he talks about metaphor. Of course, there were people who build their whole interpretation of the Bible on the fact that the laws are metaphorical or predictive or meant to convey a story, and those people were Christians. In other words, the laws of the Bible were to sort of prefigure the New Testament. So the Jewish philosophers deny that. The Jewish philosophers said those would be taken literally. But their opponents said, no, really, you don't do it literally. You are not observant enough. And in the same, Yehuda Al-Fakhar, who had an exchange with the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, and accused the philosophers of taking everything, including the law, allegorically, the Radak writes back and says, there's not one rabbi in all of France who is as punctilious an observance of the law as I am. On the other hand, we know of Jewish philosophers who are not great Talmidei Chachamim. There's a great story. This is Yosef ibn Kaspi in the 14th century writes to his son about how the importance is of developing one's mind, one's intellect, etc. Then he tells a story about how he guests in the house and his milchik spoon dropped into the fleishik pot. And he didn't know whether or not he could feed his guests or not feed his guests. So he ran off to the rabbi to ask the rabbi. And the rabbi made him stand there and wait and the food to get cold before the rabbi could finish his meal and have time to discuss it with him. So we learn from this that he took halacha seriously, but he himself didn't think that he was a posek, that he could decide these issues. So the issues are not halachic issues from the Jewish, again, medieval Jewish philosophers. I'm not talking about modern Judaism. I'm not talking about other people read the Bible. I'm talking about the people who are saying that Ezekiel never flew from Iraq to Jerusalem are not saying don't observe Kashrut, don't observe the Shabbat. They say observe that, especially the Rambam himself, who was such a great rabbi. Yes? It's not metaphorical. In other words, if all of the conditions were met, one would have to apply the law. The fact that they never were met is an historical fact. But the fact that it was meant to be, it didn't mean that it's metaphorical to some sort of problem of between parents and children, whatever. It's meant, literally, it just so happened that there was nobody who fulfilled all those requirements. Yes? Good question. Did the Rambam believe in miracles is the question. Late in the Rambam's life, he wrote a treatise on resurrection because he had been accused of not believing in resurrection. And he wrote there describing what miracles are. And it would seem, for the great part, miracles are well-orchestrated parts of nature that have great timing. In other words, for most miracles, you can find a naturalistic explanation for why they occurred, but that happened at the right time. But basically, Maimonides says that miracles were implanted at creation. And actually, there are two rabbinic statements which are the basis of this. Start with one yesterday. What does it say about the water? The water stood in Chomami Minami Salam. And then it says, they return le'etanam. They return back to their strength. In other words, they return back the way they were. And the rabbi said, "Tanai hitnai tam." That God made a condition with them. With the word etanim, etanam, he take the word tanai. It doesn't mean tanai, but the condition. God made a condition when He created them. He said to them, "When the children of Israel come, you're going to split. If you're not willing to do that, I won't create you." He said, okay, we'll do it. So they returned to their condition. The other source is in Pirkei Avot, about the 10 things that were created eve of Sabbath at twilight. You know this Mishnah, there are 10 things that were created on the sixth day of creation, Erev Shabbat, at twilight. There were... And what were the 10 things? The mouth of the well, Miriam's well, and the mouth of the ass, Bilam's ass, and Moses' staff, and whatever. There are various different opinions. And what is one opinion that comes to the very end of it? Anybody know? What does it say? Tzvat bitzvat asuya. The pliers that made the first pliers. Why did those pliers have to be created Erev Shabbat? It's part of creation. How do you make pliers? You take metal, you hold it with pliers, and you hit it on an anvil, right? Well, where do you get the pliers with which to hold the metal to make the pliers? Well, you need a previous set of pliers. So where did the first set of pliers come? At creation. You don't have to anymore? Yeah, that's before they had forms and whatever. Anyway, what do we learn from this Mishnah, by the way? A very interesting Mishnah, in addition to the question of implantation of miracles. First thing is that Chazal had a sense of humor. All right, they did have a sense of humor. But what I like about it is the fact that it teaches us that God is very much like we are. He can't get everything done right before Shabbos either. Even he, the last minute, oh, I forgot those 10 things. Oh, I better do them quickly. All right, so that's the implantation of the miracles. Again, how seriously Maimonides took this is very difficult, because Maimonides, for instance, says that what is impossible is determined by the intellect. And he gives an example. He says, like, an elephant the size of a flea. Elephant the size of a flea, you could imagine, but there can't be an elephant the size of a flea. Does that mean, because God, why can't God make an elephant the size of a flea? Because if it's the size of a flea, it's not an elephant. What do you mean it's not an elephant? It looks like an elephant. Talks like an elephant. Whatever. You know, how do you capture an elephant? You take a telescope and a matchbox and tweezers. And you reverse the telescope and you look through it and you see you reduce the size of the elephant, take the tweezers, put in the matchbox. Well, why can't that happen, right? Because the definition of an elephant precludes it being the size of a flea, which means that things have real attributes. Things have real qualities, and those real qualities can't be set aside even by God. That which is impossible, Maimonides says, is really impossible. You can't have a square circle. You can't have a married bachelor. Now, what things are like a square circle, a married bachelor? What things are like a flea the size of an elephant? And what things are like the splitting of the Red Sea? That, Maimonides says, I don't know. But I know that the intellect has to determine it. Yes?
But we have shown a lot of intellect cannot.
So, but I don't know if the Rambam would necessarily agree to that. And the Rambam, how did he explain the two different versions? As far as I remember, he doesn't explain it. Ibn Ezra gives a good explanation. The first Ten Commandments in Exodus is what God said. The second set of Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy is what Moses said. Ibn Ezra. Excuse me? I don't care if I rate him like it. You like it. I like it. I mean, that's what Ibn Ezra said. I mean, like, and he has a great example. It says, what does it say? It says, don't covet your neighbor's house. Don't covet your neighbor's wife. Don't whatever, etc. That's what it says in Exodus. What does it say in Deuteronomy? Don't covet your neighbor's wife. Don't covet your neighbor's house. What does Ibn Ezra say? God knows that first you should get a job, and then you should get a place to live, and then you should think about getting married. And therefore he said, first don't covet the house, then don't covet the wife. Moses knew with whom he was dealing, and he knows that they're not going to wait to get a job. They're not going to wait to be able to support themselves. They're not going to be able to wait to have an apartment and a house. They want to get married right away. So first he said, don't covet his wife. So this is what Ibn Ezra says. He changed it. What did the Rambam say? I don't know. I don't think the Rambam deals with this question. But if you say to me there are things in Jewish tradition which seem to be miraculous and not understandable, I'll agree with you perfectly, entirely. If you say to me the Rambam accepted those things as being non-explainable and to be outside the realm of the intellect, I don't think so. The Rambam thought that one could actually, if not prove what was discussed, one can explain it in such a way as to make it compatible with reason. And one of the ways in which he made it compatible with reason was by saying that these stories were visions and not true historical events. And as I said, this opened up the gates to the question is, what really happened? What is a vision? What is an historical event? Maimonides never tells us. What he does say is he says, learn from the examples I give you from the examples that I didn't give you. And we have to assume that the examples he didn't give us are the more problematic, sensitive, difficult examples, not the easier ones. In other words, Maimonides is not telling the whole story because he wants the reader who's capable of figuring out for herself, and the reader is not capable not to have his or her faith damaged as a result of what he wrote.
Believe that God created the world, like it's, otherwise he'd sort of have it two ways. And also, did he believe in hashgacha prati, like divine
providence?
So, yeah.
Okay. Yes, it would seem. The question is, if Maimonides thought that miracles were implanted with creation, would it seem that he implies he believes in creation? That would be true if we knew for sure that Maimonides believed in miracles. He explained, thank you for making me clarify. He explains that the miracles were implanted in the creation. But as we saw, he's very iffy about miracles. Let me give another example. The sun stood still, right? Joshua said, Shemesh begivon dom, the sun and givon should stand still. What does Maimonides say? It was a long day, and the victory was fast, was quicker than they thought. The sun did not stand still. And most Jewish philosophers did not think the sun actually stood still. So the real bona fide miracles that occurred, according to Maimonides, are really very small, because most of them can be explained as being prophetic visions or allegorical. So the example of these people who lived long lives, is either by good nutrition or by miracle, that's a problem for him. That's why he was made fun of by Yudah Al-Fahar, who said, oh, he saw only one camel flying, not three camels flying. So if indeed Maimonides did believe, I mean, there are different ways of explaining the Rambam, and this is the fight over Rambam's legacy that went for hundreds of years, and it's still going on. It's what the Rambam really meant. So if he believed in miracles, he probably also believed in creation. But it's interesting. He says we have to believe in creation or to believe in miracles. And he says creation of nothing, but Gersonides, 150 years after Maimonides, says, well, that's interesting, because all the miracles were created something from something. So really, the world was created, but not from nothing, but from something. In terms of providence, Maimonides' view of providence is also very problematic, and there are different views about what he believed. But even at the most conservative interpretation of the Rambam, it's certainly not the sort of personal providence that one is taught in religious circles. That providence is a function of one's intellectual achievements and conjunction with God. And I have this, also I have this fight with the students, because after they tell me that God doesn't have a body, I said, well, part of God's not having a body is God is not involved in what happens in the earth, and this is a sort of a corollary of it. And if you ask Maimonides, if you ask them, some of them, many of them are teachers. I say, if someone believes that God has a body, would you call that a childish belief? And they say yes, because that's what children believe. Children believe that God is this old man sitting on a throne or whatever they believe. Well, I said, well, in like manner, Maimonides would assume that if you believe that God personally intervened with what happens on earth, that's a childish belief. That God wanted people to believe that, so that they would observe the commandments, but it's not what really happens. And if you think it really happens, then you still have a childish belief. That upsets the students no end. You know, what do you mean? No, this is really true. All right. So Maimonides, as I said, was successful on the incorporeality part, very unsuccessful in most of the other things he tried to instill.
I'm trying to figure out how he would explain, if he says it's coincidence or, you know, nature, the story of the Exodus or the with Pharaoh, and that, and the one would come and Moses would say, okay, next time something else is going to happen if you don't behave, and then another thing's going to happen if you don't behave. How did Moses or Hashem intercede in this, or is that supposed to have been just an imagination?
Well, let us say Maimonides did think that these are actual historical events, the 10 plagues. And let us assume also that Maimonides believes that they were exceptions to nature. He doesn't talk about it, but one could extrapolate from what he's saying is that Moses, having a superior intellect, could figure out the things, what would happen in certain circumstances. Now, this is not so far-fetched. I've seen the Hertz Chumash here floating around. Read the Hertz Chumash. He has a great explanation. I mean, the Hertz Chumash, notice the difference between the Hertz Chumash in the 30s and the Arscroll Chumash in the 90s, the 80s, 90s, and their approach to questions like this. But Hertz Chumash explains about how the mud caused the Nile to look like it was blood, and as a result of the pollution of the Nile, the frogs came out. Because the frogs died, this brought the vermin, and because of this, and the darkness was an eclipse. And you say, but it was 3 days. And it didn't say the darkness was 3 days. It said they didn't leave the house for 3 days. The eclipse was the eclipse. But they were so frightened, they stayed in the house for 3 days, et cetera, et cetera. So this would be a Maimonidean move. I'm not sure Maimonides would exactly do that, but one could say that would be a Maimonidean move, that Moses, knowing when the eclipse would come, Moses knowing when the Nile would be polluted because of the superior intellect, could predict these things happening. But one doesn't have to see it as supernatural or direct divine intervention. That's what I'm saying, and I'm starting to get the high sign. You want one more question?
Yeah.
Okay.
How do we deal with that if there is no providence? If God doesn't interfere in the world, then what's the point?
I'm sorry, it's hard to understand you.
Right? If God does not deal in the world, if there is no interference by God, then how can anything we do make a difference? What's the whole point of it?
Oh, so, okay, I didn't quite hear all the question, but in terms of human behavior, most of human behavior, correct human behavior, is to get a good society, for Maimonides. Certain people in society will also then be able to go beyond society and societal needs to develop their intellect, and the development of the intellect is that which will lead for them to personal happiness or success or life after death, etc. Most people, according to Maimonides, most people at death simply disappear. Karet, they're cut off, that's the end of their lives, no eternal punishment. Some people have eternal reward. Whether that's personal eternal reward or partial eternal reward, that's also unclear. This is in Maimonides' introduction to his commentary on the chapter Tchelek, the 10th chapter of the Mishneh Sanhedrin, gives a long description of afterlife and reward and punishment, and also the fact why it's important for the masses to believe in reward and punishment. His introduction to the commentary on the Mishneh in general talks about why, if the purpose of humanity is to achieve intellectual perfection, and most people can't achieve intellectual perfection, why do all those people exist? He explains there that it's to serve those people who can achieve intellectual perfection. Maimonides was an elitist, and his way of reading the Torah and the Bible was not necessarily accepted by the Jewish people over the years. As I said, I'll go back to my beginning point. When it came to incorporeality of God, Maimonides won. When it came to everything else, or almost everything else, and how to read the Bible, and how a Jewish philosopher would read the Bible, Maimonides was basically not accepted because his method was too intellectual, too cold, too unemotional, and Maimonides says all emotions are bad, and therefore was not acceptable to the vast majority of the Jewish people. But I was asked to talk about how Jewish philosophers read the Bible and not how most Jewish people read the Bible.
Thank you very much.